sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Sharon Megdahl of the University of Arizona, an expert on water usage in the desert, both in the Middle East and here in Arizona. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This week we are coming up on the longest days of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, including the summer solstice on June 21st. Interestingly, there are Jewish holidays more or less associated with each of the equinoxes, spring in March and autumn in September, and with the winter solstice in December, but not so in June. This actually demonstrates some interesting things about Judaism and really about all religion. Allow me to explain. Judaism, unlike other ancient traditions, views God as the creator and master of the natural universe. Rather than seeing the sun and moon as gods, or the celestial objects as independent deities, we have always understood the entirety of nature as being the result of God's initiating creation. You can call this a religious form of the Big Bang Theory, if you like. I tend to think of it that way. God began all creation out of nothing, creation ex nihilo, it's called, and without spending too much time talking about cosmology and the formation of the universe, the central idea is simply that the sun, moon, planets, stars, galaxies, and other celestial entities revolve and rotate and expand or contract in ways that were initiated by the original act of creation. These heavenly bodies are fascinating to look at and study, but they aren't seen as impacting our lives directly through some spiritual or mystical process. But we Jews have always lived in this world, and that means we are also influenced by the surrounding cultures, that we are also interested in utilizing the ideas and concepts others have found relevant and important. We just use them in ways that incorporate and demonstrate the central idea of one God and God's role in forming and shaping the whole of the universe. In nearly every culture in the world, the place of the sun in the sky has been of interest, and it often has been the central focus of religious practice as well. In Egypt, the sun god Ra was an important deity, as was Aton, the solar disk. Mesopotamians worshipped Shamash, the sun god, whose name became the word for sun in Hebrew. Other ancient peoples worshipped sun in various ways and aspects, and many traditions created special rituals and monumental religious places dedicated to its cycles. From Stonehenge in Britain to the Konark Sun Temple in India to the Temple of the Sun in Beijing to the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan near Mexico City. Because of the predictable, cyclical quality of the solar year, nearly every region and people on Earth has had ritual holidays associated with the dates when the days were shortest and nights longest, the winter solstice, or the days longest and the nights shortest, the summer solstice, and the dates when the days and nights are of equal duration, the spring and fall equinoxes. Those holidays have various names and rites, from the Babylonian Nisanu festival of spring to the Midsummer Day in Scandinavia and the Celtic lands, to the fall festival in Vietnam and China, to the Roman Saturnalia that was eventually transformed into Christmas. Judaism developed rituals and holidays around these solstices and equinoxes too. Passover, Pesach, near the vernal equinox in the spring, is our Chag HaAviv, our springtime holiday of freedom. Both Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and Sukkot, our fall harvest festival in the autumn, occur around the fall equinox. And in winter, of course, Hanukkah, our own festival of lights, comes at the darkest time of year near the winter solstice. So even though we don't acknowledge there being any special religious significance to the cycles of the sun, our own Jewish calendar is actually based on the moon, we still manage to cover three of the four special solar times with important festivals. We do so with holidays that are officially unrelated to the sun worship of other cultures, and that's in keeping with a kind of Jewish genius for adopting practices and customs of other peoples and traditions and utilizing them to advance the Jewish idea of monotheism and our ethical values. We do this for the spring, fall, and winter solstices and equinoxes, all of the obvious times, except for the summer solstice coming up this week. So while we certainly acknowledge that there is no religious reason to have a summer solstice Jewish festival, it seems odd that we connect to the other three crucial periods of the year for solar religiosity, while on the one day of the year that seems most likely to inspire a sun religious connection, we do Bupkis. Perhaps we don't do anything for the summer solstice precisely because it was such an important element for so many other ancient religious traditions. Apparently in Israel, the Essenes, the famed Jewish ascetic religious group active in Israel during the first century, were the only Jewish sect to use a solar calendar rather than the lunar one. At the time, the Essenes were one of perhaps 25 different Jewish religious sectarian groups in Israel. Archaeologists have found that the largest room of the ruins at Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, appears to be a sun temple. This week, at the time of the summer solstice, the rays of the setting sun shine at 286 degrees along the building's longitudinal axis and illuminate the eastern wall of this Essene room. That room is oriented at exactly the same angle as the Egyptian shrines dedicated to the sun. A couple of ancient authorities, Josephus and the philosopher Philo of Alexandria, wrote that the Essenes worshipped the sun. You know, it seems likely that in a world permeated by the glow of sun worship, Judaism would find itself in a position in which it needed to avoid establishing anything that might become a catalyst for more solar devotion. And so, no summer solstice celebrations for us this week. No special dedications on behalf of solar devotionals. All of which goes to show that in contemporary Judaism, the only kind of sun worshippers we really have are those who fly to Hawaii on vacation. But another interpretation has it that at other times of the year for solar celebrations, spring, fall, and winter, there is much that might threaten the crops in the field, the fruit trees in the orchards. This may have motivated Jews to make offerings to pagan gods, and so we needed ritual and celebration dedicated to the one God to overcome that tendency and to bring us closer to the true God. But in the summer, when crops grow well and the good Mediterranean weather of Israel poses no threat to agricultural production, there was nowhere near as much temptation to chase other false gods. And so we didn't need a special solstice-y holy day to bring us back to our religious center. Which means that there's no real midsummer celebration in Jewish life. Now, there is one additional, very, very rare Jewish holiday associated with the sun. It's called the Birkat HaChama, the Blessing of the Sun. It celebrates an event that occurs just once every 28 years, when the sun aligns in the place in the heavens that tradition teaches us is the position it was in at the dawn of creation. There are special blessings thanking God for creating the sun and blessing us with its life-giving energy. The Birkat HaChama can only be performed once every 28 years, which makes it a pretty unique celebration. For those of you keeping score, that is one time out of every seven presidential elections. I don't know of any other religious ritual that is both regular and so long between repetitions. I remember celebrating the Birkat HaChama with my small congregation in West Los Angeles back when I was 20 years old and working as a cantor attending UCLA. Well, we'll check back again in the year 2037 when it's the next time to do this sun-blessing ritual of Birkat HaChama. You know, the custom of that blessing is probably co-option of pagan sun worship, the way that Judaism subsumes so many other things into monotheism. But it's worth noting that it helps us remember that the natural world is a great gift from God, that we should be continually grateful for the blessings of light, warmth, and growth that the sun provides, all coming from our great source, God. And that's a particularly appropriate blessing that works at any and every time of year. Play us in this morning on this very long, sunny June day. Here's the delightful song of praise to God, Psalm 150, in a setting by Benji Ellen Schiller, sung by the Zamir Chorale of Boston. Hallelujah. That was Benji Ellen Schiller's setting of Psalm 150, Hallelujah, praising God with song, instrument, and drum. Water is a precious resource, and becoming more so every year in every part of the world. Our guest this morning is one of the premier experts on water usage worldwide, and especially so in the desert. Israel's use of water has gone from a critical problem to a nearly miraculous strength. Find out from Professor Sharon Megdahl how that happened and what it can teach us in America when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Sharon Megdahl. She's the director of the University of Arizona Water Resources Center and the C.W. and Modine Neely Endowed Professorship. She's professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics and the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science, serves as the director of the University of Arizona Water Sustainability Program, and the co-director of the University of Arizona Water, Environmental, and Energy Solutions Program. She was named Distinguished Outreach Professor in 2010 at the University of Arizona, and I could go on and on and on. She is the lead editor of the book Shared Borders, Shared Waters, Israeli-Palestinian Colorado River Basin Water Challenges, and goes frequently to Israel, exploring their water issues and ours. Welcoming a good friend, Sharon Megdahl. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, let's jump right to it. Explain what percentage of Israel's water they use well, what they're doing, what we should do. Just give us sort of an overall perspective on things.
Israel's an amazing place when it comes to water, because we all know Israel is water challenged like Arizona is. Not a lot of precipitation, very dry, growing population, agriculture. But Israel's a real success story in what it's done with its water resources on a number of fronts. Two most notable around the world is that Israel has really developed a program of desalination. And that's been over just the last decade or so. And that is providing a large proportion of the drinking water to the Israeli population. And so to get such a robust and complete program of desalination in such a small period, a short period of time, is really an accomplishment. And that's actually led them to say, we don't have a water scarcity problem anymore. Their other big claim to fame is that they reuse a lot of their water. They reuse 75 to 80% of their treated wastewater, much of it going to agriculture, and thereby freeing up good quality groundwater and their other sources for other uses besides agriculture. And then I have to say, the other thing they're well known for is just very efficient water use in their agricultural sector.
So by contrast, what percentage of wastewater do we reuse in the United States? What percentage do we use in Arizona?
In the United States, the number is quite low, and I don't even know, but it's in below 10%, I think, overall that gets reused. In Arizona, it depends upon what community you're going to. In Tucson, we reuse about 10% of our treated wastewater directly for turf irrigation, golf courses, the like. We're recharging some of it for future use. And then up in the Phoenix area, I don't know how many people know that treated wastewater is used to cool the Palo Verde nuclear power plant. And so a large proportion of their treated wastewater goes to what is considered an industrial use.
We will talk much more about water use in the Middle East in general, with Sharon Megdahl when we return on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming them from twojewishradio.com, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. It's Father's Day today, and in honor of that Hallmark holiday, we are pleased to feature a classic Yiddish song to Dad, an interesting pop jazzy version of Oh My Papa which Eddie Fisher made famous a long time ago, as sung by Eleanor Risa. Yiddish classic, which of course reminds me of two great Jewish jokes about dads. First, the boy comes home from school and says, "Mom, I got cast in a school play." "Well, what's your part?" she asks. "I'm the Jewish father," he answers. "Well, you go back and tell the teacher you want a speaking part," she says. And then, of course, the classic question, if a Jewish husband is walking alone in the forest talking to himself, is he still wrong? Of course. In any case, happy Father's Day. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Americans like to go to Israel for vacations. It's a fantastic place to go. I'm leading a trip. You'll be in Israel. Lots of trips go from all over America. Americans go to Israel, go to Jerusalem, go to Tel Aviv, go to the Galilee.
Masada.
Masada, a little bit at the Dead Sea. That's pretty much it, unless you are not from the desert, and then you might go down to the Negev and see Beersheba, or at least see some of the Negev. Where do Israelis go in Israel on vacation?
So usually most of them will go to Eilat. To suffer more.
Because it's hotter there?
It's hotter, yeah. But it's, you know, it's like San Diego. It's a combination of Las Vegas and San Diego.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's like Las Vegas, except you can go scuba diving.
Yeah. And some of them will do, you know, some of the crazy people will go do the Trail of Israel by hiking or biking.
So the Shvil Yisrael, the Trail of Israel, explain that runs from
It starts from Eilat or from Metula.
And so Metula is in the far north, all the
Metula,
way in the northern part.
All the way up.
Almost to the Lebanon
Galil,
border.
Yeah, almost of the North Galil. And to Eilat, the
farthest south.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is on the Red Sea. So, you know, really it's now that's not long if you're used to like people trying to walk across America, which mm-hmm. hasn't happened too often, or even the Appalachian Trail. But it's it takes a month. It takes people a long time.
I saw a TV show about high-tech person that used to live in United Israeli one and did all these, you know, whatever
major trails.
Yeah.
Right.
And he did like a crazy competition with himself, that he will start at Hermon.
Mount Hermon.
Yeah, Mount Hermon at the
highest point in Israel.
Will bike, will use his own money to buy food and 6-7 people join him, so they compete who will arrive first to Eilat. It took them 6 days and
wow.
something biking, but he chose the very long way. He didn't chose the 90 road. He chose like. I saw the path.
Elaborate trail all the way through everything.
Yeah, and in Judah desert,
oh my God, I saw the trail he chose. He really made it very hard.
So there's crazy Israelis, like
yeah,
there's crazy Americans.
Yeah, that's what
Americans.
I said. There is crazy, not just one that will choose or Eilat or do some hiking or a nice family trip north Israel.
The northern Israel, of course, people don't think beautiful. About this, but northern part of Israel has actually rainforest in places. It can be very, very not totally cool in the summer, but very green and very beautiful.
Yeah. Very small country, but you have all the weather and type of lands in this small country.
Well, I hope everybody has a great summer vacation. And if you aren't going to Israel, if you're in Israel, lots of great places to travel to. Thanks. Yeah. We'll talk next week.
Toda.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we share a love of wine, and the finer ways of drinking wine go back deep into human history. But in Judaism, wine has been an important beverage for a variety of reasons. We call kiddush, sanctification, the beginning of every festival, at the end of some, like Shabbat, Havdalah, various life cycle events. It's always a really important part of Jewish life. Let's talk about wine a little bit.
Well, with pleasure. I mean, I think before we talk about wine on the international scene, we do need to talk a little bit about wine in Jewish history, wine in times of antiquity. We know the Romans planted vineyards throughout the Mediterranean world. Some of the best vineyards in the south of France were first planted, for example, by the ancient Romans. But Jews eventually came along with the notion that some wine was permissible and some wine wasn't. Some wine is kosher and some wine isn't. Some wine is kosher for Passover and some wine isn't. So I think that's one thing we should talk about. Like, how can a product that's made solely of grape juice be kosher or not? How can its kosherness or appropriateness be called into question?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because there was an understanding in the ancient world that wine was often used as a libation to other gods. And so there was a sense that it could be sort of sacred for somebody else and therefore not acceptable for a Jew to drink. The very drinking of wine, for example, at a Dionysian festival, a bacchanal, would have been a religious rite that Jews shouldn't have been practicing. So I think that's part of what led to this idea that some wine should be kosher and some wine couldn't
be. Right, but then even more restrictions were placed on wine in the Middle Ages.
That's right.
When Jews lived largely in Europe, and Europe was largely Christian. So Christians were not polytheists.
No. And in fact, I understand a lot of times when you get communion wine in Catholic churches, you're getting Mogen David or Manischewitz.
Right. And yet, wine from unspecified Christian sources is considered, by some Orthodox Jews at least, to have been potentially used in idolatry,
right,
in Avodah Zarah.
By the way, not something you hear much in Reform or even conservative circles, but certainly the idea of wine being unkosher is an important part, and the Talmud has long discussions on it.
Right. So it's an idea that's been around for a long time, and I think one of the earliest reasons for it was the same reason as certain foods were arbitrarily declared unfit. Owls or whatever. It was a way of limiting, if not prescribing altogether, socializing between Jews and non-Jews in the ancient world, and sort of building group identity and a sense of community and a sense of distinctiveness, which...
We're at a time when everybody drank wine with every meal, probably, in the ancient world.
Right.
Watered form or one form or another, and probably in the medieval times as well.
Right. So the notion of being a holy people and being distinctive and worshiping one God became tied to the notion of drinking some wine at precise occasions and not other wine and not at just any occasions. I mean, we in fact don't proscribe wine the way Muslims do, but we do use it at certain times, de minimis. We can go beyond that. But
right, and even in that small quantity that we're supposed to have, Jews were not famous drinkers. You know, the idea of wine was almost to ritualize it rather than to make it a beverage in which we were to get intoxicated.
Right.
Except at Purim, of course.
Right. That will be an interesting point with which to start next week's show.
And so we shall. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An old Jewish Bubby limps onto a crowded bus. Standing right in front of a seated young man, she clutches her chest and says, "Oi, if you only knew what I have, you'd get up and give me your seat." The young man looks at the old woman and reluctantly gives up his seat. The woman next to the Bubby takes out a fan and starts to fan herself. Grasping her chest, the Bubby turns and says, "Oh, if you only knew what I have, you would give me that fan." So the woman gives her the fan. 10 minutes later, the Bubby gets up and says to the bus driver, "Stop! I want to get off here." The driver says, "Sorry, lady, bus doesn't stop here, only at the next corner. I can't stop in the middle of the block." Again, the old woman clutches her chest and says, "If you knew what I have, you would let me out right here." Worried, the bus driver pulls over and lets her out. As she climbs down the stairs, he asks, "Ma'am, what is exactly that you have?" The Bubby turns, smiles sweetly at him, and says, "Chutzpah." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You see, chutzpah is the Yiddish word for nerve or unbridled gall. It's a very Jewish characteristic. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Korach chronicles the greatest rebellion in the whole Torah, the palace revolt of a priest, a Levite named Korach, and his 400 followers against the divinely ordained leadership of his fellow Levites, Moses and Aaron. As so often seems to be the case, we Jews are our own worst enemies. The result of this insurrection is disastrous, at least for the rebels. The earth opens. Korach and all of his misguided followers are swallowed up, never to be heard from again. By tradition, the rebellion of Korach is the absolute worst revolt of its sort in Jewish history. But this is hardly the first rebellion of the Israelites against Moses' leadership, and it is certainly not the last. In a couple of weeks, the Torah portion of Pinchas will conclude yet another episode of an insider revolution, that one solved by the point of a spear. And the rebellions against Moses and God have been pretty continuous. The criticism on the very shore of the Red Sea, the Golden Calf episode, the intense unhappiness of the children of Israel throughout their peregrinations in the desert, right up to last week's story of the failed spies in Shlach Lecha. Our ancestors had a very bad habit of constantly being dissatisfied and continuously trying to overthrow the proper order of things. Whoever was in charge always got the brunt of the criticism and the lion's share of hostility. In fact, that tendency has remained a particularly Jewish one throughout our long history. While we joke about the stereotype of two Jews having three opinions, the truth is that our heritage is a contentious one. If we weren't rebelling against God and Moses, we were fighting for control of the monarchy or against Philistines or Greeks or Romans. And when actual armed insurrection was beyond us, we engaged in intellectual debates so intense they bordered on warfare. From the endless, detailed Talmudic arguments to the political infighting of the Zionists, to the Jewish socialist against the Jewish communist against the Jewish anarchists, there is a long, rich, and highly developed tradition of Korachism. Since Korach is considered to be the worst of these, I wondered if there is any clue in the Hebrew of his name. The root, Korach, has a few other meanings. One is to cut or shear things, to slice. And certainly rebellion is a cutting gesture. Another meaning of the Hebrew letters Kuf Resh Chet is ice or cold, like Kerach, to chill or freeze. Again, a kind of reflection of emotional distance and hostility. Put those together to cut and make cold, and you come up with cold cuts. Very Jewish. Well, my favorite Korach translation is the meaning baldness, kareach, which seems to indicate a lack of hair is potentially untrustworthy. My apologies on behalf of the Hebrew language to all bald people who resent this assertion. In defense, I must say that some of my best friends are bald. Well, there is in Midrash another kind of clue. Korach is considered to have been a very wealthy man, a kind of Jewish Croesus, the Rothschild, the Bill Gates of the Sinai Desert Israelites. There is a Hebrew slang term, Otsrot Korach, the treasures of Korach, which basically means someone who is filthy rich. Somehow his wealth is associated with a tendency to revel in rebellion. Let's see now. Rebellion against God's appointed leaders comes from a coldness of heart and a desire to cut, reflects the paucity of the insulating calm of hair, and is inflamed by the financial means to support true rebellion. Odd and perhaps interesting. The truth is that leading Jews has never been an easy task. Important, rewarding, essential, but never easy. If it's true that it is Shveretz Zainayid, hard to be a Jew, it's even harder to be a Jewish leader. And so I wonder, why would intelligent, caring, reasonable Jews wish to take on this responsibility? What is there about the opportunity to make this commitment that attracts talented people with other things to do in life to spend time and effort in this contentious arena? Why would someone wish to engage in the constant give and take, the automatic Jewish flow of criticism and critique that aims itself at any and every leader of substance and integrity? Perhaps the answer is also found in our Torah portion, not so much in the desire to see your enemies swallowed up whole by the earth before everyone's eyes, although that is an attraction. No, it is in the understanding, as Korach ultimately confirms, that everyone is holy in this community of priests, but that legitimate, principled, selfless leadership is also necessary for us to achieve holiness. We need direction and organization, and the practical details of everyday functionality have to be taken care of so that we can grow spiritually in holiness. What distinguishes Moses from those who rebel against him, like Korach, is his humble desire to do God's will and to further the cause of oneness and sanctity in this world. What he teaches us is that conflicts are not the goal. It is what happens after the resolution of conflict that defines us and our meaning in this world. May the Holy One bless us all with the wisdom to know that our path lies not with Korach and conflict, but with Moses and true leadership, and so with God. Our guest this morning, Professor Sharon Megdahl, is a true expert on water and its use and conservation, both in our country and in Israel and the Middle East. Find out just how this precious resource is being used and preserved, and what those of us who live in America can learn from Israel when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it, visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world, with commentary from guest newscaster Rabbi Batsheva Appel.
Shalom, this is Rabbi Batsheva Appel, and this is the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. In Israel, Likud MK Reuven Rivlin has been voted by the Knesset as the 10th president of Israel. Although a well-known politician in Israel, he is not well-known outside the state of Israel. He's known for a good sense of humor and for being a vegetarian. Rivlin opposes the establishment of a Palestinian state, although he says he will not interfere if the government decides to engage in peacemaking efforts that would lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state. In Tel Aviv's Gay Pride Parade, the Jewish Agency will be one of the participants. In the last few months, the Jewish Agency launched an LGBT group named Coming Out, Coming Home, and this is the first time that they will be marching with a Jewish Agency branded banner in the parade. Sinad Zsigeti, the member of the Hungarian parliament who was a member of the far-right party known for its anti-Semitic statements and beliefs until he discovered that he was Jewish, has embraced Judaism wholeheartedly. He is said to have visited Israel, is now keeping kosher, has taken the Jewish name David, and is engaged in serious study. Zsigeti's commitment to his new understanding of his history and his identity includes circumcision as part of his return to his roots. Mazel tov to him and his family. Here in the United States, Representative Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader and the highest-ranking Jewish member of Congress, lost in the Virginia primaries Tuesday to David Brat in a huge upset. At one time, it was thought that he might succeed Representative John Boehner as Speaker of the House, but Cantor has now announced that he will be resigning as House Majority Leader. This past week also saw the first national team training camp for the Israeli Curling Federation in Minnesota. 20 Jewish curlers, both men and women, participated in the training camp as the team prepares for the European Group C Championships in the Netherlands in October. The goal is to send an Israeli curling team to the Winter Olympics in South Korea in 2018. Helping train the curlers were well-known Jewish curlers, Terry Brownstein, a Hall of Famer who has competed in the World Championships, Neil Kay, Warren Brook, and Ray Moose Turnbull, a teammate of Brownstein's and a curling commentator on Canadian television. There is still a lot of work to be done before the team is ready for competition in October, but they showed great potential, according to the curling veterans. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Sharon Magdal, the director of the University of Arizona Water Resources Research Center, the C.W. and Modine Neely Endowed Professor. She's a professor in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics, Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science, serves as the director of the University of Arizona Water Sustainability Program, is the co-director of the University of Arizona Water, Environmental, and Energy Solutions Program, both funded by the Technology Research Initiative Fund. She's been named the Distinguished Outreach Professor at the University of Arizona and has worked extensively in Israel and in Arizona and elsewhere on water use and water resources. Lead editor of the book Shared Borders, Shared Waters, Israeli-Palestinian and Colorado River Basin Water Challenges. Sharon, we talked a little bit about the remarkable water success Israel is. I remember when I lived in Israel, 91, 92, people kept their eyes pinned on the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, because it was constantly below the level that it needed to be to provide the drinking water that they needed for the country, let alone the agricultural water. Water was constantly in the news. And you mentioned earlier in the show, in less than in about 10 years, they've managed to shift to desalination. By the way, they have now lots of natural gas to run those desalination plants. It's an almost unbelievable story. Is that a scenario that could work elsewhere? And what lessons does Israel have to teach us here?
Yeah, I think that is a scenario that can be learned elsewhere, and most closely in California.
My native state,
yes,
I might add.
Yes, indeed. California has a big coastline. It's very interesting that the Southern California area, Los Angeles, San Diego, they virtually have no local water supplies upon which they rely. Their water supplies are coming from Northern California and then imported from the Colorado River via canals. And the Colorado River is a very stressed river system. There will be shortages declared in the future. And one of the very obvious opportunities to address the water shortage problem, as we would call it in the lower basin of the Colorado River, would be for California to step up its desalination, not use as much water from the Colorado River, and then let us in Arizona use more water from the Colorado River.
This is a goal we actually like a lot.
We like that, and we don't propose to do that for free. I mean, Arizona is really serious about looking at the potential to enter into exchanges whereby we could pay for some of that desalinated water, and instead we get more water off the Colorado River. The point is that desalination is used in different places around the world. It's used successfully. There is the plant being built at Carlsbad. finally got through all the permitting stages. And so that's a real opportunity. The other opportunity for Arizona is with Mexico, because Mexico also has the opportunity to desalinate seawater and possibly enter an exchange with us.
Fascinating. Speaking of exchanges and working across borders, let's talk a little bit about the relationship with Israel and the Palestinians among and the other Arab countries in terms of dealing with water. Water used to be the kind of issue that people would go to war over in that part of the Middle East. How has Israel worked with the Palestinians on water usage?
Well, I think more people believe water is an opportunity for cooperation than war. And in fact, I just read a small book. The premise of the book is that if you look at countries in the states in the Middle East, the ones that are cooperating on water are not the ones going to war or at risk of war. So water cooperation is a good mechanism for peace, and a lot of people are advocating it as such. In Israel, they do have agreement with Jordan to provide a certain amount of water. There's a treaty that's being carried out. With the Palestinians, there's also an agreement, I'll call it agreement in quotes, regarding the use of aquifers, but there's a lot of contention about that. And there's a joint water commission that's been formed. It is the body that is supposed to be making decisions on permitting, wastewater treatment plants, wells, and the like. But at times, the commission doesn't meet at all. It's been asserted that the commission is in balance with Israel having greater authority over the ability to, let's say, get plants built in the Palestinian territories than maybe should be the case. And so I would say water is a great opportunity for more cooperation, but each side has to recognize the values and priorities of the other side. I've heard Israel say, well, we can just provide you desalinated water. I'm not sure the Palestinian territories want to be totally dependent on deliveries from Israel for their water supplies. And then the other area where I see an imperative need to improve the situation is on wastewater treatment and the flows of untreated wastewater across the border. Israel happens to be downstream in those cases, but one can not only look at it and say the Palestinians, oh, they're not treating their wastewater. There are reasons why there are impediments to getting some of these plants built. And then I have heard, I can't say for sure this is still the case, that even in the West Bank, where there are some of the settlements, there's not all, let's say, advanced treatment of the waste coming from the settlement. So it seems that wastewater treatment's an area for environmental, humanitarian, health reasons really needs to be addressed better than it currently is in certain particular areas.
There was a time when there were, when you talked about water as an opportunity for peace instead of for war, when Israel was extremely concerned about the headwaters of the Jordan, water coming in from Syria, from Lebanon. What's the situation now? Syria is in the midst of a civil war. Lebanon is always an interesting place politically and challenging. What is the water situation? Has they managed to just not mess with the water? What's going on?
Well, as I understand it, and by the way, if I can put you in touch with real experts on the Kinneret, because
I think you know more than I do, though.
I know the person for the Water Authority. I will see him at a conference who knows all these things. My understanding is that the issues with the Kinneret right now have to do with the water levels, and they have come up. You know, there's been some good winter precipitation over the last few years. And what is now the issue is, to what extent is the Kinneret pumped for the Mekarot National Water Carrier, or whether there is the opportunity to not take as much water out of the Kinneret, and then what might happen with the water not taken out. And it's my understanding that there's been an agreement to release some additional water to the lower Jordan, because a real issue is that the lower Jordan is kind of a trickle and it's poor quality. it is the inflow into the Dead Sea, and anybody who's looked at pictures or been at the Dead Sea knows that it's receded significantly. And so there is a major management issue relating to the Kinneret, how much of that fresh water flows into the Israeli water delivery system, if not as much as needed because of desalination, should more be flowing downstream? But if more goes downstream to the lower Jordan, might that get diverted for agricultural uses in the West Bank or Jordan? And so again, it comes to these multiple players all drawing from the same source. But what I hear about more is much more the lower Jordan situation rather the headwaters and the inflows.
Speaking of the lower Jordan situation, not long ago there was a huge amount of press about this, the eternal Dead Med Canal, which is sometimes a Dead Red Canal. And then they were, which is to the idea to bring seawater in and replenish the Dead Sea, which is much more saline than seawater, but still would allow water to return to it. It has receded, as you mentioned, hugely. The last I heard, they were actually building pipelines up from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea. What do you know anything about the status of those?
Well, about, when was it? A year ago, December, or this last December? Time flies. A three-party agreement was signed by the Palestinian Water Authority and Jordan and Israel to build what some see as a first phase of this sort of major public works. And it would involve a desalination plant that would be a Red Sea desalination plant on the Jordan side. And then that plant would supply some water to a lot. And also, as part of this agreement, Israel would send water to Amman, but not this desalinated water, other water from the Israel system that could go into Amman. And also the Palestinian Water Authority would get more water deliveries. And yes, the brine from the desalination would be disposed of into the Dead Sea. And this is supposedly moving forward. I'm not sure how long it is going to take to build, but this is a, I call it, no pun intended, a watershed event to get the three parties to agree to this.
To get Jordan, the Palestinian Authority, and Israel together on a water project.
And it's a water, this is an example actually of a water exchange desalination, in that the desalinated water is not going all the way up to Amman, but because Israel is getting water for a lot from this desalination plant, they are going to send some water from other sources to Amman.
So it's a creative solution to
It's a creative solution. And one of the things the listeners may not know, but Jordan is considered the third or fourth most water-stressed nation in the world. They, even in areas like Amman, where they do have potable supplies and wastewater, there's not 24/7 delivery. Many areas get delivered maybe a few hours one time a week in parts of Jordan where they have the governmental system. So there's a lot that needs to be done in Jordan so that they can have the reliability and security of water supplies that they need.
And Israel certainly has the technology and apparently the will to work together.
Yes. And, you know, one other amazing thing about Israel that is maybe for the people who think about water distribution systems, but Israel's down to, I think it's a 3 or 4% leak rate within its municipal water systems and its delivery systems. In the U.S., a goal is 10%. And if you're under 10%, you're really good.
I've heard there are systems that leak like half the water they carry.
And in fact, that's true. And that's true in some of the areas of the Middle East. And that's an area where technology, you know, when we think about technology, we think about these big desalination plants and membranes and all that. But some of the technology that's been developed by Israelis, as a matter of fact, to detect leaks and figure out where they are so you can go in and fix them, they're very advanced systems, and they're marketed worldwide, and certainly there are people in our region who would like to work with them.
I'm thinking my irrigation system at home could probably use some of that technology. But it's a fascinating subject, and one that will continue to be important. It seems like Israel's on the right path and can teach us a few things.
Yes, and if I could just say one thing in closing is to remind everybody to conserve. We all could do more to conserve. And that's part of our culture here in Arizona and certainly Israel's culture as well.
It's a wonderful shared issue. And I'll stop trying to recharge the groundwater basin by overfilling my fountain. Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout, maybe on the theme of water.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be the very funny and delightful singer, composer, a cappella impresario, Sean Altman, the leader of the duo Jewmungus. Our playout this morning comes from Sean Altman, and it's his very funny and slightly terrible song, Blame the Jews. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, a sunny week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
When I said the bad thing, you say blame the Jews. When I say anything, you say blame the Jews. Seasonal flu.
Blame the Jews.
Dog do.
Blame the Jews.
Varicose veins.
Blame the Jews.
Stubborn stains.
Blame the Jews.
Income tax.
Blame the Jews.
Hairy backs.
Blame the Jews.
Junk foods.
Blame the Jews.
Tiger Woods.
Blame the Jews.
VD.
Blame the Jews.
Asparagus pee.
Blame the Jews.
The KKK.
Blame the Jews.
Feng Shui.
Blame the Jews.
Smallpox.
Blame the Jews.
Smelly Jesus.
Blame the Jews.
The baby Jesus. Wait. We cannot blame the Jews for the baby Jesus. Oh, yeah, I guess you can. Dinosaurs became extinct. Then the Titanic sank into the ooze. Coincidence?
Blame the Jews.
That's right. Earthquake, black death, bubonic plague, bad breath.